I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. David Rusk is one of the country's leading scholars on urban America and a former mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico. In 1995, the Abel Foundation funded his research and writing of a book about Baltimore's future. It was called Baltimore Unbound. It warned that the metropolitan region, wealthy suburbs ringing a central city with a high concentration of poverty, would never reach its potential for economic growth and quality of life. David Rusk prescribed a remedy for that, a new approach to governance that would gradually end Baltimore's role as the region's poorhouse. As part of our continuing conversations about Baltimore, we invited David Rusk to Midday to again talk about the city's future. He joins us after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR. Nice to have you with us. Thanks for making Midday part of your day. As part of our continuing coverage and conversations about Baltimore in the wake of the riots and unrest following the death of Freddie Gray from injuries in police custody, today we welcome David Rusk to the show. This year marks two decades since David Rusk's warning that a city in decline could pull the Baltimore region down with it. A leading urban scholar and former mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico, David Rusk warned in 1995 that leaving high concentrations of poor blacks in Baltimore's inner-city neighborhoods would create long-term hardship for the city and six surrounding counties. The Abel Foundation funded the research and writing of David Rusk's book, Baltimore Unbound. In it, he declared that the city had reached a point of no return in social and economic decline, and that without a new metropolitan approach to the problems, the suburban counties would next feel the pain. David Rusk is an independent consultant on urban and suburban policy. In addition to Baltimore Unbound, he's the author of Inside Game, Outside Game, Winning Strategies for Saving Urban America, and Cities Without Suburbs, that book called by Congressional Quarterly the Bible of the Regionalism Movement. David Rusk has worked with and in more than 120 U.S. Communities, and he's lectured on the problems of urban America overseas as well. And we welcome him to Midday. He lives in Washington. Thank you for joining us in the studio, David.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be back, Dan.
Well, we haven't talked in 20 years because I interviewed you when Cities Without Suburbs came out in 1993, and then again in 1995. With Baltimore Unbound.
I remember it well.
Yeah, well, I thought it'd be good to reflect on some of the conclusions that you reached in that book, the prescriptions that you wrote for Baltimore, and where we are today considering what's happened just in the last few weeks.
Well, the key issue is the concentration of poverty, high-poverty neighborhoods. And let's just think kind of broadly for a moment about the concentration of poverty. You know, each of us, I, you, all your listeners, all of us, go through life with a certain level of background tension. To take a sort of a nuclear physics example, we go through life with a little low-level background radiation. But there can be things that happen to you or me, loss of a job, divorce, death or serious health crisis of a family member, for example, that can raise our tension level, raise our level of radioactivity for a certain period. But if we're surrounded by other people who are stable, low radiation people, most of us get through those crises. Now, there's nothing that produces more sustained high radioactivity than constant poverty. And when you have a family in constant poverty and it's surrounded by so many other families in constant poverty, in other words, a community that collectively is highly radioactive, it's very unstable, and practically anything can set off a nuclear meltdown. And that's what you see periodically, particularly in urban America. So, and that that particularly is true when, in effect, the control rods have been removed from that radioactive pile. In other words, the middle class, the stable middle class, has left the neighborhoods. You aren't, when you look at high poverty neighborhoods anywhere, it's not that there are many more poor people that living there now than did in the past. It's that just there are a lot fewer of everybody else. And those who remain are high poverty. And that, indeed, is the story of Sandtown Winchester and the story of so many neighborhoods in Baltimore.
And that's not just Baltimore as well.
You
identified in Baltimore Unbound, I think, 34 cities or metropolitan areas that you said were past the point of no return. And you use that phrase. I looked up what your definition of that was in 1995. You said there are 34 American cities, including Baltimore, that have passed the point of no return. And that means you're looking at disproportionately high minority populations, loss of population generally, right?
Right.
And great disparities between city and suburban income levels.
Well, I've modified that a little bit because that was based on the census reports from 1970 and 1990. 2000 showed that there had indeed been a handful of cities that had reversed their course, most notably Chicago, which had gone through a tremendous regentrification of the neighborhoods around the loop. They'd knocked down a lot of the public housing, like Robert Taylor Holmes and Cabrini Green, and build all these yuppie townhouses and condos. And so Chicago made it back up the scale a little bit, got off my index. But there are a lot more communities on it now than those 34 then.
You know, you just said the G word. We had a discussion about gentrification on the show here a few weeks ago, and other people keep bringing this up all the time. When you talk about dispersing the poor, your idea was a regional approach to providing people who want to leave the city to move to a better neighborhood, better schools and all, the ability to do that through housing vouchers and other means that we can talk about this hour. But that G word comes up because that's a radioactive word for some people, because it means, well, you're pushing poor people out, forever changing the character and culture of neighborhoods to bring in yuppies. And is that how you see it? It's not as simple as that, is it?
It's not as simple, but if you ask a person, almost any person, do you want to live in a neighborhood where, if you're a homeowner, the value of your home is constantly declining, where there's growing crime levels, where your schools are so poverty impacted by poor children that they really just can't do the job, jobs are that are easily within reach are disappearing? Is this where you really want to live? And the answer of an awful lot of those current residents would be, no, I want to get the hell out of here. I certainly hear those voices of opposition to gentrification in favor of let's keep the culture in these neighborhoods as it is. An awful lot of those advocates tend to be folks who don't live there and, if given the choice, would not have their families live there and send their children to those neighborhood schools, sort of the professional, if you will, apologist. And I think the pity is when you look at urban America or at Baltimore, there are plenty of poor white people, but poor white people almost never live in poverty neighborhoods in the Baltimore area.
You mean they're more integrated?
They're
more dispersed through.
Yeah,
the
they're more dispersed through the different income levels. Look at the Baltimore area. If we define a poverty neighborhood as 20% or more, and a high poverty neighborhood is 40% or more poverty, and that's really quite high, and a hyper poverty neighborhood is 60% or more, of all the poor whites, only 23.7% lived in poor neighborhoods, and only 2% lived in high poverty neighborhoods, where for poor African Americans, it was 72% in poor neighborhoods and 33%, one third, in high poverty neighborhoods. You see, so the issue of concentration of poverty is color coded not only in the Baltimore area, but really largely throughout metropolitan United States.
Address this for me. A gentleman wrote to me the other day saying, why do you keep quoting Rusk's prediction that a declining Baltimore, the central city of the region, would pull the whole region down eventually? That's not true. We're out here in Howard County, Columbia, and we're thriving. Ellicott City, places like that. He said, that's not true. It didn't work out. We're thriving out here. We don't need Baltimore.
Well, first of all, if you really went by the census definitions, Howard County has more people working in the Washington metropolitan area than in the Baltimore metropolitan area. It ought to be seen in strict terms as part of the Washington metropolitan area. And although the District of Columbia certainly has its neglected pockets of poverty, on the whole, the city's doing pretty famously. But when you think of Baltimore as well, it's really a bifurcated city. You know, there is the black, largely poor black city, and then there's the others, and there's still a substantial white and black blue-collar population. But if you look at Baltimore, the average white residence income of the city is over twice that of the average black residence. On the other hand, if you go to Washington, D.C. and just look at the District of Columbia's residents, white incomes are three times those of the blacks. If you go to Atlanta, where gentrification has gone forward even more, its white incomes are four times those of African Americans. So this also reflects in all these places that a substantial portion of the black middle class has left the central city and is living out in the suburbs now. What we really have to do is, even with gentrification, is to create balance so that there are always mixed income neighborhoods. There are always a certain level of low income families in a community.
But the idea that the counties will, you know, decline along with Baltimore, will feel that impact, that it will hurt the counties in some way. I'm not sure that our listeners who live out there, Harford County, Baltimore County, Carroll, Anne Arundel, Howard, sense that. I think there are people out there who care about the city, of course, and dread what's happened here. Others shrug their shoulders and don't care at all and don't see the connection.
Well, I haven't... for this show, reviewed the data. But the data generally show, when you look at urban America, that regions with struggling central cities have overall a slower rate of economic growth than regions that have strong, more balanced central cities. I say, hey, I'd have to check the numbers for Baltimore. And it's arguable as to whether a place like Howard County is really being fueled by employment in Baltimore City or employment in the Washington metropolitan area.
When you came to town 20 years ago, when the book was published and you were giving speeches about it and interviews about it, did people understand that concept when you pitched that to them, that the central city had to thrive or the whole region would just experience slow growth, wouldn't live up to its potential?
Well, one of the problems is that there are plenty of people and organizations, like the Greater Baltimore Committee, for example, who sought to embrace that notion, but bringing about very fundamental change in the rules of the game, the federal rules, state government rules, very importantly, et cetera, is very tough. First of all, there's just the inertia that we've always done things this way. Why change? But secondly, there are plenty of powerful interests that benefit from the current rules as they are. And there are plenty of people whose view is, I've got mine, my family's doing fine, my kid's going to a good school, what me worry? Well, that's inarguable from their own personal short-term point of view. But that's not the framework, the vision on which great cities and great regions have been built.
David Rusk is our guest in this hour of midday. You might call this Baltimore Unbound Plus 20. 20 years after David Rusk's book on Baltimore and its future, we're having a conversation with him this hour. And when we get back, we'll talk a little bit about what's happened here in the last few weeks and get David Rusk's reflection on that and some of the other things that have changed or not changed over the last 20 years since he published his book. You're welcome to join us with a question for our guest. 410-662-8780 is the local phone number, toll-free long distance. Good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And our email address is midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday, a conversation in this hour of the show with the leading urban scholar David Rusk, author of Baltimore Unbound, A Strategy for Regional Renewal, which was published in 1995. It was funded by the Able Foundation, distributed by Johns Hopkins University Press. David Rusk, also the author of a well-known book called Cities Without Suburbs. What were your thoughts when you saw rioting erupting in Baltimore, saw and heard the news that there were fires, vandalism, looting here? Following what had been, you know, mostly peaceful protests of this death of Freddie Gray and from injuries in police custody, what did you think when you saw that in Baltimore?
Well, I was saddened. I'm never one who has characterized such explosions as, quote, a rebellion of some sort. I think, when desperate folks perceive that in effect the framework of law and order is broken down, and it's sort of a field day of looting and the like, but it turns inward on the communities. I mean, it's destroying the very backbone of the communities in which they live. But I wasn't terribly surprised, including the fact that it was the epicenter was Sandtown, Winchester. I can recall 15 years ago, certainly maybe 20 years, close to 20 years, when the Enterprise Foundation, James Rouse's vision, launched an effort that was greatly magnified by a Clinton administration empowerment community, Enterprise Zone, and I think something I saw a newspaper report, something like $130 million was put into that supposedly a comprehensive effort to provide everything that Sandtown needed. I thought at the time, that's not going to work. And it hasn't. You just don't deal with concentrated poverty by trying to sort of lift the people in the community up marginally. There's got to be a dramatic change, and for most of them, the change is to get the hell out of that radioactive nuclear pile and into a stable community where they can deal with their problems in advance.
Quoting from Baltimore Unbound, no combination of urban renewal, downtown development, model cities programs, community development corporations, and I predict enterprise or empowerment zones has ever reversed the downward slide of such cities, meaning cities that have passed the point of no return. There is no factual basis for believing that more of the same, including Baltimore's new federally funded empowerment zone, will reverse Baltimore's decline. And you noted in the book that Baltimore was pretty good at carrying out all these projects especially when there was a lot of federal money.
Absolutely, right? And certainly nobody has done sort of downtown renewal practically better than Baltimore. The Inner Harbor is a marvel, and a great resource, not only for tourists, but clearly for residents of the region as well. But around the country, there are a lot of showcase projects like that. I always look at the neighborhoods. What the devil is going on in the neighborhoods? What is the profile there? And even in a lot of cities that are termed, quote, comeback cities, you find that the quality of life in the average neighborhood has been declining because of the growing concentration of poverty. For this show, I went back to the data, sort of like a sportscaster saying, let's look at the videotape.
Mm-hmm.
And I compared the number of poverty and high poverty and hyper-poverty census tracts throughout the entire region between 1990 and the latest census reports, which is 2013. And back in 1990, there were 5 census tracts, neighborhoods, in Baltimore City that were 60% or more poverty, which is a horrific level. There are still 5 in 25 years later. High poverty neighborhoods, 40 to 60%. There were 30 back then. They're now 16. I think some of those were places like where the former Lafayette Courts and Lexington Terrace and Flag House and Murphy Homes were located. They've been completely redone in mixed-income communities.
Right. Those were high-rise public housing projects that were demolished starting in the late 90s.
That's right, and they were rebuilt as lower density, but most importantly, mixed-income communities.
That's right.
Going from a 90% public housing to 10% market rate for the first one, which was Lafayette Courts, I think. And to one-third public housing, two-thirds market-rate housing for the last one, which may have been Murphy Homes or Flag Court. I'm not sure which. I think the latter number is what you really should be shooting for. But when you look at the level of 20 to 40% poverty in the city, it's grown from 63 tracts to 103 tracts. Hmm. So there's been a substantial spreading out within the city.
That's 25 years.
That's
23 years.
23 years,
from
basically.
1990 to 2013.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
I wanted to note, if you don't mind me noting here, when you mentioned that the public housing projects came down, right after the year your book was published was also the year that a large class action suit was filed against the Housing Authority of Baltimore.
Yes, Thompson versus HUD.
And Housing and Urban Development.
Right.
Which led to a federal consent decree calling for the city to disperse more of the poor from this segregated, what do we call them, public high-rise ghettos of concentrated poverty, establishing that there had been a pattern over a whole century.
Well, you know, and those have been carried out through hundreds and hundreds of housing choice vouchers, federal rent subsidies that have had to be used in neighborhoods of less than 10% poverty and less than majority minority. So a great many of those have been used in suburban areas. Overall in the region, the poverty rate's gone from 10.1 back in 1990 to 10.8. In 2013.
And that's the whole region. By the way, does that include Queen Anne's County?
That does include Queen Anne's County.
The census tract or the census region that you're looking at there.
It includes Queen Anne's County.
Are the counties I mentioned, the city plus Queen Anne's. Yeah.
So the poverty rates have gone up pretty modestly in all of the suburban counties. Anne Arundel, 4.5% to 6.3%, for example. Baltimore County, 5.5% to 8.8%. Whereas in the city, the poverty rate has gone up from 21.9% to 23.8%. And even looking over in Queen Anne's County, for example, 6.7% to 14.7%. But the real interest is Howard County, because Howard County probably received the largest number of those Thompson versus HUD
vouchers.
And they went overall as a county from 3.1% poverty to 4.6%. There's no census tract in all of Howard County that the highest poverty rate is 14.2%. That's probably an older area of one of the first built areas of Columbia.
Okay, so a point about this, that would you say from the numbers then that the counties are absorbing more of the poor, that those, 3,000 families that have been moved out under the Thompson versus HUD consent decree settlement have moved to the counties? That may be part of it, right?
That is part of it, and in a sense it's a partial carrying out of the recommendations that I had 20 years ago. We have not seen the counties adopt in their own inclusionary zoning laws. The city of Annapolis did, Baltimore City did, although I think they largely fumbled the implementation of that. But
and Montgomery County has had
the
it
Montgomery
for 40
County
years.
Model, that's yeah. right. Montgomery yeah. County continues to be a famously successful community.
One of the remedies that you prescribed in Baltimore Unbound was that the region adopt this idea of inclusionary zoning for,
yes.
for any, I think it was for any development of 50 homes or more.
That was the Montgomery County model. They're now at 20 homes or more.
And explain that to our listeners, David. What is this basically setting aside affordable housing, right?
Well, what it really says to a private builder is if you want to build in this county, a certain proportion of your units in every development has to be affordable to people in the lowest third of the income scale. To give you Montgomery County's formula, if you're a builder and the zoning allows you to have 100 units of housing, market rate housing maximum on your land, county says, well, 15 of those 100 have to be affordable. But they also say, Mr. Builder, we're not going to direct you to reach into your pocket and pull out your profits to subsidize this. We're going to give you an automatic density bonus of 22%. We're going to let you build 122 housing units on that land. Those 22 bonus units, at least 15% of those, or three, must also be affordable. So the overall project, instead of being 100 units of market rate housing, becomes 122 units, 18 affordable units, but 104 market rate units. In effect, the builder has picked up four market rate units for free land for mm-hmm. no cost.
Mm-hmm.
And because just as a matter of implementing a public zoning policy.
And you end up with economic integration.
You end up with economic integration. It's the only affordable housing policy that I know of that almost guarantees that the children in the affordable homes are going to be going to overwhelmingly middle-class neighborhood schools.
David Rusk is our guest here on Midday. 410-662-8780 is the phone number if you'd like to speak with the author of Baltimore Unbound. This program we'll call it Baltimore Unbound Plus 20, taking a look at David's book from 1995 here on the show. We'll go to the phone lines, David, take a couple of questions for you. Jonathan in Baltimore, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask your guest, how much, as far as the decline in Baltimore, would you say is attributed to the poor mismanagement of the city's budget? You have the highest taxes for homeowners to live in Baltimore, almost twice the rate of Baltimore County. Not to mention the school systems are not particularly bad because of the poverty, in my opinion. It's because they hire inexperienced teachers in this region. So how much of it is poverty versus just the poor mismanagement of the city? Thank you.
Well, you know, what you've described could be a reflection how you would describe central city after central city after central city in their schools. And after, as I have done, after you've run into that argument 40 or 50 times, you begin to think to yourself, wait a minute, there's something else going on here. It can't be that all these cities have had inept mayors and corrupt city councils and incompetent school boards and administrators. What you're dealing with is growth patterns reflecting policies, state policies as carried out by local governments, federal policies. Federal government has been the greatest economic segregator in America over past decades. And so it's, you know, I can show you, for example, throughout the 565 municipalities that carve up the entire state of New Jersey, just to the north of Baltimore, the wealthiest communities in terms of the tax base per capita, their property tax base per capita, have the lowest property tax rates. and the poorest communities with the lowest tax base per capita must struggle, and they have the highest property tax rates. Carried to a larger scale, that's somewhat the explanation for why the level of taxes in Baltimore City is much higher than the level of taxes in Baltimore County. There's a disparate tax base per capita between the two.
When you were doing these examinations of these cities, you kept coming back to poverty, correct?
Yes.
Concentrated poverty.
Yes, indeed. That's the key question.
Poverty, children who come out of poverty, go to schools, it's been seen time and time again. It takes more to educate them, more effort to educate them because of the deficits they bring to school.
Well,
and you have a school system that's constantly underfunded because the tax base isn't sufficient to support it.
Well, and how much money do you think you need to spend to make up the if you will, the social deficits?
Right.
The Dutch national government funds every school in the country. Every public school, every private Catholic school, every private Protestant school, every private Jewish school, every private Muslim school, of which there were 32 when I was last in the Netherlands. And they do it through a very progressive formula where they spend almost twice as much money to educate a low-income immigrant child as they spend to educate a middle-class ethnic Dutch child. But they have found, after decades of doing this, that when the low-income immigrant children are all concentrated in what have come to be called schwarz schools, the black schools, spending twice as much money doesn't make any difference. What works is having the immigrant children out, you know, with middle-class ethnic Dutch children. To really be able to learn effectively. And one can use that same parallel in this country. It's been demonstrated over and over again by research.
Here's another caller for David Rusk, our guest on Midday. Frank in Bel Air. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Thank you, Dan. And I actually worked as a patrolman back in the old Lafayette projects there. It was quite an experience. But when I started in the police department in Baltimore, and I really think this is a jobs thing, people would leave the police department to go to Bethlehem Steel or General Motors and stuff. And I really think the problem is that all the good jobs have left the area through globalization, and I was disappointed with the, it looks like the trade package is going to go through. So, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest things, and I know your particular interest, Dan, is ex-offenders getting jobs. So, I mean, those jobs aren't out there, so it's almost like we're managing the decline rather than, you know, by the way we've exported jobs.
That point of deindustrialization.
You'll have to pardon me. I lost my hearing about 10 years ago, and I hear with a cochlear implant. And although I have the earphones placed over it here on the air, I just didn't pick up much of what you had to say. Perhaps Dan would...
Well, he was making two points. Okay. One is to address the impact or the effect of deindustrialization on cities like Baltimore specifically, and what that led to. And also he mentioned ex-offenders, people who come home from prison and have difficulty finding jobs. Back to your premise about poverty, concentrated poverty, deindustrialization reduced the number of, you know, union middle-class jobs, not even union, just middle-class jobs. And this has been going on. This has been a seismic change in our economy over the last 50 years or more.
Well, indeed, and I think that the gentleman's points are both very well taken. As I recall, Baltimore City in a 20, 25, 30-year period lost 65,000 manufacturing jobs within the city limits, and those jobs are never coming back, certainly not as manufacturing jobs. Where industrial jobs are being created now is out in the far suburbs. You know, when Baltimore was a great industrial center, its factories were located near the port, were located near railroads, in multi-story buildings. When was the last time anybody built a freight elevator, for example? All manufacturing now is single floor. It's based on highway and airport transportation. And where is there a lot of land with access to those two? It's out in the suburbs. So to the degree that there are new manufacturing jobs being created in the Baltimore region or practically anywhere else, it tends to be out there and not in here.
David, here's a question by email, a comment from Yindra, who says, Gentrification brings a reminiscence of redlining and housing discrimination policies of our not-so-distant past. How do we change the perception of integrating neighborhoods, bringing back middle-class families, and equalizing structural inequity without recreating segregated neighborhoods?
Well, one of the ways is to recognize that market forces are going to be very powerful when you have both historic, architecturally interesting neighborhoods located within easy reach of concentrations of high-quality professional employment. And yet you want to maintain the economic and racial diversity of those neighborhoods. I think that there must be conscious programs of both the government sector and of the private nonprofit sector to be purchasing a certain proportion of the still very affordable, you know, row houses, et cetera, before gentrification takes over, either knocking them down or fixing them up, so that as rental properties or as properties to be purchased by modest income families on long-term desirable terms, you're going to maintain the ability of you're going to take a certain amount of the housing stock, you will, out of the marketplace of gentrification
and keep it affordable.
I've seen this happen
right.
in some communities. The Crispus Attucks Community Development Corporation up in York, Pennsylvania, owns about 110 units in the historic neighborhoods of York that are slowly now going through gentrification. They'll always own those.
So keep it inclusionary.
That's right.
And you have to do it. You have to manage these things.
That's right.
You just can't let the market roar, right? Yeah, it has to be. It has to be carefully managed. You have to keep it inclusionary. We're going to take a break here, David. We'll come back. David Rusk is our guest. We take some more phone calls. 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Dan Rodericks, 410-662-8780 with David Rusk visiting us today from Washington. You wanted to share some more data with us, David?
Well, just thinking in terms of, and this is an old study that I did, but I doubt it's that very changed. The best anti-poverty program is to have a married couple or at least a two stable adult family. A two-earning adult family. When you go back to a past sentence, and I don't think it's probably changed very much, of all the white married couples with children in the Baltimore region, 98% were not poor. Of all the black married couples with children in the region, 94% were not poor. Of all the Hispanic married couples with children in the region, 95% were not poor. Yet 24%, a quarter of the white single mothers, 30% of the Hispanic single mothers, and 47% of the black single mothers and their children were poor. So, I mean, that in a sense, that is the key. But let's look at what happens once again, in the poorest neighborhoods of Baltimore City, in the poorest neighborhoods, the ones of 40% or more poverty, there were four single mothers with children for every married couple with children, irrespective of
four
race.
Four to one.
In all the rest of the Baltimore metropolitan area, except for those, as I recall, 45 census tracts. In all the rest, there were three married couples with children for every single mother with children. So basically, there was a 12-to-1 swing in terms of the family structure between the poorest areas, like Sandtown, Winchester, and everywhere else. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons for you know, trying to deconcentrate poverty, to give children exposure to far more instances
of married couples.
Married couples, mm-hmm. working dads, et cetera. And we structure there are neighborhoods of Baltimore where 60, 70, 80% of the children are growing up poor.
What do you do about that? You give people the opportunity to live in places where they just have an exposure to a different culture, a different life, and better schools and all of that.
I think if you look at the reports, especially the stories of individual families who have been relocated through the Thompson versus HUD Regional Housing Mobility Program, you can see the success.
Well, I want to ask you about that. This is important because Thompson versus HUD was settled some 10 years after Baltimore Unbound was published, and then there was a resettlement in 2012. So the numbers I got from that the other day, 2,800 families have moved in some way to better neighborhoods using the vouchers provided.
To dramatically better neighborhoods,
yes,
than where they were.
Low-poverty neighborhoods.
That's right.
Okay. There's another 7,100 families on a waiting list. And I got that number from the American Civil Liberties Union the other day, Barbara Samuels, who's been overseeing this.
Who've been the champions of fighting the battle of Thompson v. HUD.
I mentioned it for two reasons. One, to support your point earlier about, you know, the poor people do want to live in better neighborhoods. Gentrification concerns aside, this is the truth. The 7,100 people waiting for vouchers to move. 7,100 is a significant number. And those vouchers, of course, you'd need money for those vouchers. I guess that's what the waiting on it is. But that would be a significant movement, would it not, for Baltimore?
Yes, it would. Some combination of federal funding, state funding, even local funding, would be money very well spent. I can recall when I was giving a talk up in Rochester, New York, some years ago, back in the 90s, and I was talking about Montgomery County, Maryland's policies and about housing subsidies and specifically about housing choice vouchers. And at that time, the average subsidy was $500 a month, $6,000 a year. And somebody said, isn't that awfully expensive? And I said, look, I don't want to suggest that all public housing families, all public housing children are potential criminals, you know, but your county executive has just vetoed the building of a new county jail because that county jail would have cost $130,000 of capital per bed and $40,000 of operating cost per bed.
To construct it, you mean?
To operate it.
It.
All right, you know, now, doesn't it make more sense to spend $6,000 in a way that has a high probability of success as opposed to $30,000 a year, you know, $40,000 a year, which is almost going to guaranteed to fail?
And theoretically, so to stretch it out, family moves to, say, Harford County someplace, Howard County, Anne Arundel County, better neighborhood, kids go to school, they grow up, they have a different life than they would in Sandtown, Winchester. They don't need that subsidy eventually, right?
That's right.
In theory. So you're putting this money up front in order to move people, or give them the opportunity to move. You're not mandating it.
Well,
all voluntary.
You know, from a civil rights perspective, it could simply be expressed as, let's try to make sure that poor black families are treated in the same way as poor white families. Poor blacks, right now, 3/4 live in high poverty neighborhoods. Poor whites, only 1/4. You know, if we even get to that, there would be a very, very substantial improvement for everybody around.
Let's take another call for David Rusk while we have him here just for a few more minutes. Jay in Baltimore, with your comment or question, please. Jay.
It's a comment. Can you hear me okay?
It's not great, but try to be brief, Jay.
All right, I'll take the earpiece, boots of all. My comment is that I feel as though the economic desperation in Baltimore is a result of the local area being so dependent upon local it's singular industries and singular, like, there's a handful of companies like Bethlehem Steel and things like that. And when these companies pulled out, just a few entities pull out, and the whole, there's basically no jobs. And I think that we have to have a more self-sustaining economy. If we just rely on one other big company or industry to come in, we're setting ourselves up for the same thing to happen again in the future. But if we start from the ground up, I'm talking about from local farming to local manufacturing of goods, and have a more localized, self-sustaining economy, then we never have to worry about the jobs going anywhere, and there will actually be opportunities. The crime and everything else, I think, will really subside dramatically if people actually have jobs and opportunities.
Jay, thank you very much. Let me read you, David. I appreciate Jay's comments, but I want to read Steve's comments here. He says, the myth of the American dream is that anyone, however humble or difficult their circumstances, can, through hard work, succeed economically. What I hear Mr. Russ saying is that the concentration of poverty can trump this myth. Does this myth of the American dream also contribute to an indifferent attitude among the higher income residents of our region toward alleviating Baltimore's concentrated poverty through inclusionary zoning?
As I said earlier, there are an awful lot of people who feel that they benefit from these kinds of separations, these kinds of policies. That is, the ones that have concentrated poverty, particularly in the black community. So I think the premise of his question is very true. The point is, you really got to take the debate out of the theoretical and say, look, we're talking about the woman who is on the dry cleaning desk, where you go every day. We're talking about the nursing home orderly who's taking care of your aged mother
and maybe
several miles away. We're talking about the checker at your local store. We're talking about the EMT in whose hands your life may depend sometime. I mean, all of these people, and some of them, if they have several dependents, can be working very modest wages and yet really not be making it. All of these people are essential for a community to function. So it's not a question of the way I would describe it as the poor. It's a question of anybody who's good enough to work here is good enough to live here. And are we going to make provision for that?
The one other piece that I want to mention before we get off the air with David is, you know, the 7,100 people waiting for vouchers. You also need to have places for them to live. You need to have affordable housing available for them to use those vouchers.
And that's why inclusionary zoning can be such a powerful tool, because it can bring affordable units in place on a very scattered basis, integrated into middle-class market-rate communities, without really the expenditure of public funds to get it built. It is built through the power of zoning.
David Rusk, I appreciate you coming back to Baltimore to be with us today and talk about this again. And I'm going to recommend to people, go back. I know it's 20 years old now, but go back and read Baltimore Unbound. I think there was an updated edition also of Cities Without Suburbs.
There is
was
that,
done.
Yes.
There's that book, too. So thank you very much for all your thinking and thoughts about this, David. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
It didn't solve all the world's problems, but we certainly gave you more to think about. And in the hour ahead, we'll have open phone lines for you, a chance to call back if you didn't get into this hour of the show. We can discuss some of the things you heard in this hour with David Rusk. I hope you enjoyed it. I have some emails to read as well. More ahead, another hour of midday after lunch. And we take our lunch today from Eddie's of Roland Park and thank them for providing lunch for our guests and our staff who sneaks a sandwich once in a while. We'll see you after the news. Please stay tuned.